The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, apparently it's never too early to discuss the 2024 presidential election. Republican hopefuls are in Iowa this week. Next week, the Georgia Republican Convention gets underway to mobilize its members. Meanwhile, here's a question. What are the Democrats up to? Is there a dilemma for the Dems in trying to keep its party energized? It's the first part of a three-part series dissecting Georgia for 2024. And today, we talk about the Democrats when political strategist Fred Hicks stops by. Also,
the more these sensors get embedded and become invisible to us because they're part of our everyday technology, I think the harder it becomes for us both to realize the risks because we forget all of that activity is being picked up at the same time.
So what are you thinking and why and who's making you think that way? Confused? Don't be. Duke University professor Nita Farahani will talk about risk and challenges of neurotechnologies for human rights. It's all in her latest book, The Battle for Your Brain, Defending the Right to Think Freely in the Age of Neurotechnology. You don't want to miss that. Those conversations coming up, but first, a check of these headlines. Finally, the first new nuclear reactor built in the U.S. in decades is now at full power in Georgia. As Molly Samuel reports, it's a major milestone for the long-delayed project near Augusta.
Plant Vogtle's two new reactors were supposed to be up and running years ago, and the total price tag has more than doubled to over $30 billion. Still, Georgia Power touts the nuclear expansion as a source of reliable, carbon-free energy. This first new reactor can generate enough electricity to power 500,000 homes and businesses, according to the company. Georgia Power customers have been paying for the financing for the project on their bills for years. Once the reactor goes into commercial service next month, they'll start paying for the capital costs, too. Molly Samuel, WABE News.
Speaking of power, Georgia Power bills are going up, and some scammers are taking advantage of it, as we hear from Emily Jones.
The bill for a typical Georgia Power residential customer will go up nearly $16 a month starting in June to cover high natural gas costs. And some companies may use the price hike to try to sell rooftop solar panels. Georgia Power says customers should beware any promises that solar will eliminate or drastically reduce their bills. It is possible to reduce costs with solar, but under Georgia's current system, any savings are often modest, especially in the short term. Anyone considering solar should compare multiple quotes and carefully review all the terms. Georgia Power and the Georgia Solar Energy Association both have guides online and can help customers find reputable contractors. The utility says customers looking to lower their bills can also consider energy efficiency upgrades, as well as energy assistance programs for low-income families and seniors. Emily Jones, WABE News.
DeKalb County is closing part of its municipal landfill. Officials say it's because it's reaching capacity, but as Dormia Vance reports, residents have been complaining for years.
The Seminole landfill menaces just beyond the tree line in the Rock Mill neighborhood in South DeKalb.
It's like covering half the sky.
Joyce Cox lives in a neighborhood about a mile away from the landfill.
It smells like gases, like terrible, like you can smell like methane. You just stink. It really smells like a lot of garbage.
Cox grew up here, and over the years, the landfill has grown to what he calls a monster. At least six other landfills have closed in South DeKalb over the last 40 years. Jacqueline Eccles with the South River Watershed Alliance says the area is predominantly home to Black people.
And it all goes to who is least likely to fend off, you know, the siting of a landfill and who has the political clout and the money you know, to fight the siting of landfill.
In 2005, the county stopped any new landfills from being opened and operated, making Seminole the only place for trash to go. Now, DeKalb plans to close the part of the landfill closest to the Rock Mill neighborhood. It's building a new disposal area within the landfill's footprint. Andrew Cawthon is with the county. He says that should relieve residents from the bad smells.
No additional waste, solid waste, will be placed near this community. This cell will be covered with dirt and grass will be planted on top of it.
Some residents like Cox say they like to see the landfill shut down, but it's very unlikely because the trash has to go somewhere. Officials say construction for the new cell will be completed by June 1st, but the site still has to be approved by the Georgia Environmental Protection Division before it's open for operation. Dormaya Vance, WABE News.
Now, I've got good news and bad news. I have my producers, Daniel and LaShawn, here in the studio. Which would you like first, the bad news or the good news? Probably the good news. Just yell it out. Daniel?
Good.
The good? All right. Good news. Summer's around the corner. And in Georgia, summer means peaches. The bad news? This year, the fruit will be almost entirely unavailable. Eee. University of Georgia horticulturists say a changing climate has wiped out roughly, wait for it, 90% of the Peach State's crop. Don't get mad at me. Listen to WABE Sam Greenglass.
The last time things were this bad was 1955. That's according to Lawton Pearson of Pearson Farm in Fort Valley.
I didn't see it. I wouldn't laugh. My dad was only six. My grandfather picked two peaches, and they went to California for the summer.
Peaches need a minimum number of chill hours below 45 degrees to set fruit. But the first 3 months of the year were the warmest on record in Georgia. And chill hours here have been declining over the years. That's climate change. Growers are experimenting with new varieties that need fewer chill hours. Some of those did get the cold they needed, but right when they were blooming, an unlucky frost.
You have a low chill peach that was perfectly fine with this winter. So it bloomed, and then it got four nights under 28. Can't win either way.
So don't count on sinking your teeth into a local peach anytime soon.
Not Georgia peaches. I don't think you'll see Georgia peaches in a grocery store.
Pearson's summer staff will be down to 40 from the typical 250. He can't retreat to California like his grandfather did in 55. The business has diversified, including a growing pecan crop. But Pearson says looking at trees with no peaches is painful.
Oh, God. Yeah.
One bright spot, the few that do make it benefit from having all the sun, water, and nutrients to themselves.
The peaches you're left with sometimes are fantastic, and they're huge, and they're sweeter than normal. Like, the peaches we have are awesome. It just leaves you wanting more.
Pearson's ready for the end of peach season in August, so he can look to next year. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
And finally, the remains of a U.S. soldier missing since the Korean War are now back home. Luther Herschel Story was just 18 years old when on September 1st, 1950, a wounded Story and his fellow soldiers of the 9th Infantry Regiment were reportedly about to be surrounded by North Korean troops. Now, as the 9th Infantry prepared to retreat, Luther Story stayed behind to cover their withdrawal. That would be the last time he would be seen. Army Private First Class Luther Herschel Story was buried yesterday at the Andersonville National Cemetery near his hometown of Americus, Georgia. Story, in a ceremony with his closest living relative, a niece, Judy Wade, posthumously received the Medal of Honor. His fate was unknown until the U.S. military matched DNA from Story's relatives to a set of unidentified bones in April. And also, we want to bring you some news that has just come into our WABE newsroom and here at Closer Look. In a statement from the Carter family, from the Carter Center, the Carter family is sharing that former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has dementia. She continues to live happily at home with her husband, enjoying spring and plains and visit with loved ones. And WABE will have more regarding this news later today during All Things Considered. This is Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues now from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. I spoke with a class at Georgia State University. One of the students asked me what concerns I had about our industry as journalists. Well, I said technology, because it scares me. I know I speak to Alexa every morning, but that's a different story. That's probably the extent of how I deal with that kind of stuff. But here's a question. When technology can read minds, how will we protect our privacy? Well, this has been at the core of research, examination, and potential future implications for our next guest, in particular, neurotechnology. And if you're not sure what that is, keep listening and pay attention, because Professor Nita Farahani will talk about risks and challenges of neurotechnologies for human rights. The professor takes an even deeper dive in the book, The Battle for Your Brain, Defending the Right to Think Freely in the Age of Neurotechnology. I'm not finished with the book, but it scares me. But she's going to make it all right, I'm sure. Professor Farahani is the Robinson O. Everett Distinguished Professor of Law and Philosophy at Duke University and founding director of the Duke Initiative for Science and Society. Professor, welcome. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's begin by giving definitions to a term, a main term listeners will hear throughout our discussion, because I think it's fair. I always tell my producers we approach each segment as there's somebody that has no idea what we're talking about. So when we talk about neurotechnology, what is it?
So the book talks about a particular area of neurotechnology. So I'll back up and say neurotechnology generally is the technology that has been developed to be able to peer into our brains and to be able to decode what's happening there. And that could be as broad as a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine. These are like big MRIs that a person goes into that can look into their brain and look for things like brain abnormalities or tumors, or, you know, people go in for CAT scans that look into their brains. So it's really something that peers into the brain and tries to decode what's happening there for health or for other reasons. The book that I've written looks at technology or neurotechnology that's coming for broader accessibility to kind of everyone. And this is, I think the best way to think about it is, people are used to small sensors in their watches or in their Fitbits or in their everyday devices that pick up things like heart rate and footsteps. Brain sensors are small sensors that are placed on the scalp or inside the ear or behind the ear that pick up the electrical activity in the brain. And this is every time you think or, you know, have a emotion or anything's going on in your brain, neurons fire in your brain. Those happen in patterns where hundreds and thousands are firing at once. And these sensors can pick up that activity. And everybody today is talking about AI, right?
Yeah.
And AI is able to read those patterns of activity and then decode and make sense of what it is that those patterns of firing mean. So are you happy or sad or all sorts of things?
So is it too colloquial to call this brain tech for someone listening?
No, I think I think brain tech or brain sensors. I mean, really, it's like everyday sensors in the way we think about heart rate sensors and Fitbit sensors. The difference is just what it's decoding.
Absolutely. And so from there, if we were on this battle for your brain game board, if you will, we would hop to the good square. And you talked about, you gave examples for our listeners, neurotechnologies that have enhanced our quality of life, or health and wellness is probably at the top of that, correct? That's the good.
Yeah.
That's the good square.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the good square is we have not taken our brain health as seriously and treated it as aggressively as the rest of our physical health. I think it's extraordinary that in today's day and age, most people know things like what their heart rate is or what their cholesterol levels are, but they know virtually nothing about what's happening in their own brains. And so the ability to quantify, see, treat, access your own brain activity has extraordinary health potential.
Okay, so that's the good square. Now we're going to jump to, I don't know if I should call it the bad square or the unknown square, because in a TED Talk that you gave some years ago, and this struck me, I'm going to quote you here, "I believe we need a right to cognitive liberty as a human right that needs to be protected. If not, our freedom of thought, access, and control over our brains and our mental privacy will be threatened," close quote. And then herein lies where we are now. Take that further for our listeners. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, so that's the both known and unknown square, because it's already happening and it's going to happen at much greater degrees. So the problem is our heart rate doesn't have the potential for the same kind of abuse and discrimination as access to what's happening in our brains, because the electrical activity in your brain reflects how you're thinking and how you're feeling and what you're thinking and what you're feeling. And when corporations can gain access to that and buy and sell your brain data or use it at work to monitor your brain activity, or governments can use it to interrogate your brain for criminal actions or look at your political preferences and biases, the risk is profound.
Okay, someone says, well, Professor, each of us as individuals, we can control that in a sense to keep someone from hacking our brain. Is it easy to do? Does it mean I have to disconnect today, and live off the grid?
So first of all, I'd say today it's easier to do. It's getting harder every day, right? I mean, so brain tech, as we're going to describe it, are the sensors. But well before then, there's all kinds of AI that's being trained to pick up everything you do on your computer and even your microfacial changes to try to figure out what you're thinking and feeling. Mm-hmm. Now attach devices into your multifunctional devices. So you're wearing headphones right now, Rose, right? Imagine if the soft cups around your ears had 20 different sensors that were picking up your brain activity so that you just forget, right? You're on the radio show, you are going about your everyday life, you're taking conference calls, and your brain activity is being decoded in real time. The more these sensors get embedded and become invisible to us because they're part of our everyday technology, I think the harder it becomes for us both to realize the risks, because we forget that all of that activity is being picked up at the same time. And then there are the contexts in which you don't have a choice, right? Workplaces are already requiring people to wear different brain tech to track their fatigue levels or their attention. Mm-hmm. Governments are already mandating it in some countries.
Let's talk about that, the workplace, because where some employers, especially in these work from home setups, they already track our keystrokes and other computer use on employee devices. How does this current practice set up some of those concerns for neurotech use at work?
Yeah. So surveillance at the workplace has become widespread, right? I mean, during the height of the pandemic, companies surveyed, more than 80% of them said that they were using so-called bossware on computers, whether that's keystroke logging or figuring out what applications people are using or even turning on their webcams to look at them at home and see what they're doing. So it's been normalized in some ways, right? People are starting to get used to like surveillance in the workplace. But go ahead.
No, go ahead. I have so many questions.
Well, I mean, so the next part of that, what's already happened, right? So for more than a decade, a company out of Australia has been selling to companies the ability to track fatigue levels for commercial drivers and for pilots. Mm-hmm. And maybe fatigue levels are a good thing to track in that context. But in the same way that you can track fatigue levels, you can track whether a person is paying attention or their mind is wandering, if they're engaged or bored at the workplace. And that's already happening, mandated by some employers in other countries as well.
Well, could this lead to people feeling pressured then to comply with workplace surveillance and tracking? I mean, just out of necessity of having a job. And should an employer, in a job description, before you hit send for that resume, should all this be presented? And should they be transparent about this?
So one, absolutely, they have to be transparent about it. That's assuming that they do it at all, right? I don't think that they should be tracking things like attention in the workplace. I think that what that does is both undermine morale of employees, erode their trust, and create really kind of an Orwellian workplace that, a person doesn't even have the ability to think freely. Forget the fact that I actually also think it's not good for the employer, because turns out periods of mind wandering are helpful. That's where people are the most creative. So I think it creates a bad workplace for people, and it doesn't measure the right thing, leading to worse outcomes for everybody.
This was actually a question from a listener, but it's actually in my script as well, because in the book you explore this, and you just mentioned this, decoding brain activity and the use of artificial intelligence. And I have a question from a listener that says, well, with this decoding brain activity, are there any legal protections, Rose? Ask her.
Right.
I like how they put it in caps. Ask her.
Yes. I mean, and ask her is right. So, I mean, the answer is no, right? I mean, there you can stretch some of the existing laws. And in some states, for example, in the workplace, there are some restrictions on the collection of biometric data, bodily information from employees. But that basically just requires that there be disclosure and transparency that it's happening, not a prohibition on doing it at all. I'm, you know, part of the reason that I wrote this book, you can think of it as kind of two things at once. One is a big wake-up call. This is technology that's here. Everybody's anxious about AI. AI applied to decoding your brain has both upside potential, but a lot of serious concerns for mental privacy and freedom of thought. And the second is to articulate this right to cognitive liberty, what the foundation of it would be, what the rights are that we need now to enable us to go into this, you know, kind of future that really is targeted to our brains and mental experiences.
In fact, you write, I believe the right to obtain and record your own brain activity should be included within our understanding of the right to privacy and right to freedom of opinion and expression in international human rights law as an essential precondition to cognitive liberty.
That's
that
right.
Also,
because
go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is self-determination, right? So it's, some people write about technologies. I mean, look, like there were a bunch of people who just signed this, like, let's take a big pause on AI. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to work, but I also don't think that's the right approach. I think that trying to harness technology toward human flourishing, toward what actually makes us better. And part of that is, like, we should have a right to access what's happening in our own brains. We should have a right to be able to know what's happening and to be able to enhance and change our brains if we want to. We just need to keep other people from doing it to us, right? Mm.
The voice you hear is Professor Nita Farahany. She is the author of the book, The Battle for Your Brain, Defending the Right to Think Freely in the Age of Neurotechnology. I want to shift for a moment, Professor, because look, let's be really clear. Neurotechnologies is big business. It's big business. And I was reading where, you know, we already know it's a billion-dollar industry right now. But anyway, you've talked about the good and then the unknown. But this could be considered a 21st century technology. And where do you see, if it's done correctly in terms of, you know, these therapies and approaches and processes, you see it being the really good for humankind? You see that? I'm just curious.
I do. I mean, right. So, you know, while physical health and overall longevity is increasing, neurological disease and mental health is getting worse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of that's, we know precious little about what's happening in our own brains, and we have very little self-access to it. You know, you have to go get into a big clunky fMRI at your doctor's office at their order in order to see anything about what's happening in your brain. And that's one snapshot at one moment in time, right? Imagine empowering people with the tools to be able to see and change and improve what's happening in their own brains. I think the upside potential is huge if done well.
You served on a presidential commission for the study of bioethical issues, I think under the Obama administration. And when you look back to that time and where we are now, what have been some of the biggest changes in this field? And I mean, are there issues?
You know, it's interesting. We took on a 2-volume report called Gray Matters when I sat on the commission. And we were asked by President Obama to look at what was then that he launched the U.S. Brain Initiative, which was really designed to develop tools to better understand the human brain. Mm-hmm. And we were in early days then, right? There were some of the ethical issues that were presented, but the idea of broad, like at scale across society, neurotechnology in the hands of individuals, that was kind of a pipe dream back then. Now it's, you know, every major tech company is launching a product from Meta to Snap to Google to Apple that embeds brain sensors into everyday technology. It's gone from being a medical application to a consumer application. And the people who are driving it are the same tech companies who've brought us good technology and also commodified all of our personal data.
Well, listen, we have the FDA, which monitors, you know, consumers, you know, products and services for consumers to make sure it can best benefit us and not harm us. Are there ethical guidelines to the industry? Who sets the borders here? That's a great question.
And the answer is, I mean, maybe it's, you know, FDA if it comes to health applications. But when you're talking about consumer applications, really, you're mostly talking about the FTC. Mm-hmm. And it's about whether or not there are false claims that are made. You know, in terms of overall protection of consumers, maybe, you know, the Consumer Protections Bureau is looking at it. But the kinds of harms that they're looking at are not the kinds of harms we're talking about. They're talking about like whether the product, you know, explodes in your hands or something, mm-hmm. or causes burns. It's not, does it enable peering into, you know, tracking and hacking and changing your brain in ways that mm-hmm. could really fundamentally alter what it means to be human. There's nobody who's watching over that aspect of it.
So if there's no federal oversight, you know, and sometimes states pass their own, you know, laws, their own statutes, might you see states looking at this, if they haven't, because they're too busy trying to keep, you know, Black history out of some classrooms, which I don't understand that.
Right.
That's a whole nother show, Professor.
Right.
So might you think states start looking at this?
I mean, I think they will, right? You see some states that are forward-looking in terms of biometrics. You see states like California that have innovated around privacy and trying to understand, you know, how to better protect consumers in that space. You see states like Wisconsin who've started to integrate specific protections in terms of the collection and misuse of brainwave data. Mm-hmm. But you also see states intentionally interfering with freedom of thought of students, banning books, banning conversations in classrooms. And the things that I worry about, which is the interference with even the ability to think freely, mm-hmm. you already see states comfortably doing that without technology being involved. And so, you know, can you imagine them reaching further in still and to say, no, it's not just that you can't have access to information to think about these things. You can't even think about these things. I don't think it is an impossible stretch of the imagination if that's what they're really after, is to try to prevent people from thinking freely about issues.
Is there a lobbying group or collective that is just right now so, I don't want to use the word powerful, but you know, would state lawmakers be up against some powerful, you know, proponents of this? And then maybe perhaps they don't even want to deal with it.
So, you know, it's interesting because even though I say that, right, which mm-hmm. is that there are attempts to interfere with the right to think freely, whether you talk to somebody who is incredibly liberal or incredibly conservative, everybody seems to agree that we need a space that is not interfered with. What, mm-hmm. you know, literally like what your inner monologue is, your inner thoughts ought to remain with you in private, that you ought to have a space where you can think about whatever you want to think, mm-hmm. and that's really fundamental to human flourishing. I believe this concept of cognitive liberty should and could be a bipartisan issue, that across the board, we would agree that even if we don't agree on other aspects of privacy, mm-hmm. this is critical.
But as you know, also when state lawmakers are grappling with something like this, and if it's at a committee and they want to bring in folks who are experts, so to speak. So if you were brought in and they said, Professor, mm-hmm. if you could wave a magic wand, because that's how state lawmakers talk sometimes, what regulations would you like to see put in place?
So I think it's going to be context specific. So the first thing that I want is a broad right to cognitive liberty as an international human right. And then we need to apply that in context. And one of the first contexts I think we need to apply it is in the employment setting, right? Which is a right to not have your brain monitored in the workplace. And that could be, for example, that employers give you access to the technology, but they don't have access to the data, right? Mm-hmm. So if you want to have tools that help you focus more in the workplace, that could be wonderful and helpful for a person, or tools that help you to meditate and bring down your stress levels. Terrific. By all means, offer it to employees, but don't use it to collect data and to make decisions about employees to promote, hire, and fire them. And so those kinds of context-specific regulations, from its use in the education setting, its mm-hmm. use in the employment setting, the fact that corporations can't gather and collect your brain data, those are the context-specific applications of the right to cognitive liberty. But I think we need to start by recognizing mm-hmm. the broader umbrella right.
And finally, Professor, as we wrap up, what does this say? And if folks haven't gotten it by now, listening to these last 22 minutes, what does it say about the urgency needed to address safeguards and regulations in neurotechnologies?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, Rose. I think people, when it comes to generative AI, feel like they were caught off guard. This is happening just as quickly, and it's about to go at scale across society by all of the major tech companies. We have a moment, and I literally mean a moment, to get this right. Pauses don't work, but working in advance to put the terms of service in favor of people so that this technology can be empowering rather than oppressive. We have a moment to get it right, but it is incredibly urgent that we take this shot now to secure to everybody a right to cognitive liberty.
It's called The Battle for Your Brain, Defending the Right to Think Freely in the Age of Neurotechnology. The author, Professor Nita Farahany, is the Robison O. Everett Distinguished Professor of Law and Philosophy at Duke University and founding director of the Duke Initiative for Science and Society. Professor, compelling conversation. I'm going to go home and tell Alexa to stay out my business.
Please do.
Thank you
so much for having me.
No, thank you for taking time. Compelling conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Yeah, you know, it's never too early to discuss the 2024 presidential election. You know, Republican hopefuls, they're all in Iowa this week. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has landed in the Hawkeye State for his first presidential campaign event. Also expected, former President Donald Trump, his Vice President Mike Pence, current Senator Tim Scott, and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. There could be more. Who knows? Now, next week, the Georgia Republican Convention gets underway to mobilize its members. That'll take place in Columbus. Trump is expected to speak. Governor Brian Kemp has said, don't look for me to attend. Meanwhile, here's a question. What are the Democrats up to in all of this, or does it matter this early? So we'll ask Atlanta-based political strategist, a guy who will defend poll numbers to the end and whose dog apparently has its own Instagram account. Fred, your credibility on this program just went Fred Hicks.
People can't see it. That means that it went up really high.
No, that's not what I did. Why does your dog have its own Instagram page?
Well, he has his own personality, you know, and he has his own fandom. So, you know, he has to give the people what they want.
And you want listeners to trust you with presidential predictions and polling numbers and all that stuff.
I mean, if he barks twice, I mean, we trust a groundhog with weather reports, right? So why not trust a cavapoo?
Okay, Fred. Let's begin with Iowa, because you know what? For a while, there was a buzz that Iowa was losing its steam in terms of being this test for presidential hopefuls. But apparently, it's still the place for a candidate. Why? Why is Iowa so important in all this?
Well, you know, it's a caucus, which means that it tests your ability to organize. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really important as you go throughout the remaining states. You know, can you get your supporters there? Can you move block by block and have captains and all of that? And it's also the first in the nation. So it gives people a sense of not just your ability to organize, but your appeal and to whom you appeal.
So how is that measured? Are candidates going to look at the enthusiasm of the crowd? Are they polling? What's taking place during this time there besides just giving a speech?
So all of that. So they're testing out their messaging. They're testing and meeting with key people to see if they can get them on board. And here's the other thing that people don't realize is that when you're doing a presidential campaign, someone, an organizer or a precinct captain or someone like that, they'll get their start on the ground in a place like Iowa. And if they do well, they'll stay with the campaign. They'll go to New Hampshire. They'll go to South Carolina. They'll go to Georgia, go to California. And so someone could very well start out as just an organizer on the ground. And by the end of the campaign, be someone very high up in the organization. So it's testing a lot of different things there, including who are going to be your faithful soldiers, so to speak, that you can move around the country.
Are the Democrats going to pay attention into, I guess, the energy of the crowd? Do they have folks lurking around there just trying to get a feel?
Oh, for sure. For number one, you always have a tracker. So you're hoping that someone's going to make a mistake or say something that you can use later on down the line. So the major candidates will certainly, there'll be a tracker on them. Major candidates being the ones that we're already talking about, mm-hmm. right? I mean, Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, people like that. And then also you're going to be listening for any kind of fissures in the campaign, and then things beyond that from a policy perspective that you might be able to take advantage of. But everyone's interested in what happens in Iowa and then, of course, in New Hampshire.
Now, so far, we've got more than a dozen folks collectively who we know are running or thinking about running or whose names are just fun to throw out there. I mean, you even got, you know, Christie out there, which you never know. But right now, if you're the Democrats and you're paying a little bit of attention, and we know that Trump is obviously he's leading DeSantis.
More than 30 points.
Yeah. Is there a one or the other that's better for the Democrats to start thinking about this early, how to challenge them, how to strategize against a Trump or DeSantis?
So Donald Trump has been very good for Democrats. That's why we were able to win Georgia in 2020, 2021. And then Senator Warnock was able to win in 2022.
But that was then, Fred.
Right. And so he's lost, what, four or five consecutive elections, if you count his own. Right. So and he is an easy foil, so to speak, for Democrats. So people can raise a lot of money. And one could argue that in 2020, it wasn't as much about Biden-Harris as it was the country didn't want any more of Donald Trump. As far as Ron DeSantis, it's interesting. He's chosen to hew a path to the right of Donald Trump. And his comments post his glitchy Twitter announcement last week have really started kind of positioning Trump as a bit of a moderate. And he's saying that Trump is losing his steam. And so whereas I think a few weeks ago, people would have thought, oh, man, Donald Trump is really it. Given the culture wars that Ron DeSantis has waged in Florida around don't say gay, around
DEI,
and his battle with Disney and things like that, he has moved himself up the ladder in terms of being a person that the Democrats hate, despise, and or fear. And so I think when you're looking ahead, those two Democrats and people in the middle are like, those two cannot be president. And so I think Ron DeSantis, someone another wins, that'd be interesting. But got to watch for someone like Tim Scott, right, who is just as conservative, but he doesn't talk that way right now. Mm-hmm. And he's obviously being African-American, the only black person in the Senate. According to Lindsey Graham and other Republican Senate leaders, that there are a number of Senate Republicans who are supporting him. They're just waiting for Trump to trip and fall, and they're going to flow to him.
Is that trip and fall, much of that could be related to this Fulton County investigationist probe, which we don't know what charges are going to, if any, charges right. come out. We're looking at maybe August or September, whatever that may be. But do Trump, his base, do they even care?
So they do not. And so for Donald Trump, the more the merrier with respect to the number of candidates in the Republican primary. That's how he won in 2016, right? So you just have to have the most delegates. And so if you have people out there slicing and dicing and carving up the electorate for him in the primary, that makes it better for him because his people are going to be his people. And you're not able to dislodge that.
Is there someone you're watching that who has not officially said, I'm running, Mike Pence, that you think whatever happens in Iowa this week we might see in the next couple of weeks or next month?
Yeah, you know, Mike Pence's vice president is a very interesting candidate because he was Donald Trump's vice president, but Donald Trump has basically said he wishes he wasn't his vice president, and so he's not going to really be able to pick up any kind of support from being Donald Trump's vice president. I think the one that I'm still watching, and we talked about it, we were actually the first ones to talk about it before everyone else started running with it, was Brian Kemp, you know, Governor Kemp here in Georgia. We talked about that, November 9th, the day after the November 8th election, with him vanquishing David Perdue and then beating Stacey Abrams, that he's a name that Republicans should consider, and apparently that's something out there. If you look at his leadership committee and the money he's raised there and all of that, he's going to be a force, whether it's as a presidential candidate or as a potential vice presidential candidate. So there's someone like that, I think. And then, of course, we talk about Mike Pence as well.
You mentioned Tim Scott. Listen, there are a lot of candidates on the GOP side that, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Folks can, you know, kind of parse out. On the Democrats, it's Biden and Harris. I mean, you got Kennedy, it's launched.
And Marianne.
And Marianne. Williams. So those are familiar names.
Right.
You know, for what it's worth, I don't know how much in terms of, you know, energy is behind those names, but
right.
Biden's approval ratings ain't good.
They're not.
As my English teacher would probably turn up. What do you say? They ain't good. But so if you're the Democrats right now, what do you do? Do you try to just weather this? Do you need to get some messaging out there? Do you need to at least just run some ads saying, hey, we want to remind you of what the Biden-Harris administration has been able to do?
Absolutely. You know, I say this a lot when talking to people, that the Biden-Harris administration has accomplished more legislatively than the Obama-Biden team did in their first 4 years. But no one would know that. I talk a lot of times on air about my son, right? And he's 22 now. And we had a big discussion last year. He was like, so what has Biden done for me? And then we hear that discussion a lot from voters, particularly African-Americans and African-American men. And so that's something that the administration is going to have to work on. They have a record, whether you like it or not, but they have a record, and they need to communicate that again, whether you're talking about the infrastructure bill, whether you're talking about COVID-type relief money, whether you're talking about rental assistance money, those kinds of things. And they're not doing a good job of that.
Well, then where does that fault lie then? The DNC, one could say, what y'all doing? Why aren't you taking this opportunity?
So, they pledged in January or February last year, they being president and the vice president, they're going to go on this, this barnstorming tour throughout 2022 and talk about their legislative record. And that did not happen, at least as far as I could tell. I think with this debt ceiling thing out of the way and...
Well, allegedly.
Allegedly, supposedly.
It's Washington free. Right. You never know.
For sure. If it is out of the way, right, then I think they will immediately turn to making the case. Because a key component of this debt ceiling deal is that we won't go through this again next year. Mm-hmm. They're pushing it off for 2 years. Yeah. I think both sides see that as an advantage, because if you're Speaker McCarthy, it gives you 18 months to just go after the administration and try to, and frame the message however you like. But also, if you're Biden Harris and the DNC, it gives you an opportunity to message as well.
There has been some leadership changes within the DNC. Is there another star power person that they need? Stacey Abrams now is at Howard doing Stacey Abrams things. Is there someone else that maybe the Democrats need to push out there just in case?
to run next year?
Well, I'm just saying, whatever.
Well, I think someone who's really interesting is Gavin Newsom, the governor of California. He has spent a good portion of the last year attacking Ron DeSantis. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You have these two Disney governors, right, who are on the opposite side of the administration of the corporation, who they've been going at it. So I think Gavin Newsom is very interesting. He's far to the left in many respects because it's California. Mm-hmm. But I think he is someone who's very, very interesting. I think when you go beyond that, there are a group of up and comers. I don't think they're ready to make the jump just yet. But mm-hmm. once we get past the 2024 cycle, I would be paying attention to people like Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader. I'll also be paying attention to someone like an AOC, who started out, so to speak, as on the far left and has mm-hmm. moved a little bit more to the middle, but is very very good at getting attention to issues and raising money. I think also you have Wes Moore, the new governor mm-hmm. of Maryland, who he's only been in office for a few months now, 4 or 5, but he's someone who's getting a lot of attention. And I had the privilege just 2 weeks ago of being in Chicago for the inauguration for the new mayor up there. And let me tell you, he is a very interesting person, and if he's able to turn Chicago around, mm-hmm. I think he's someone who can see. He had that it factor. Sitting in the audience, watching his speech, listening to his speech, watching how people responded to it, seeing the diversity in Chicago, I'm like, oh, this could be America.
He would have to in Chicago and a lot of cities. I'm not picking on y'all, Chicago folks. Don't send me an email. Chicago with all these issues and obviously around public safety and some other issues. Yeah. Atlanta has its issues with public safety. So if he turns that around, maybe he gets some people saying, but.
Right. That's a big if, because
you got to work on Chicago. Before we move to the Georgia's Republican convention for next week, just get your thoughts on what do you think Democrats can do with Senator Dianne Feinstein? Long time. It's clear there are some health issues. We don't know what exactly, but what are you hearing from within the Democratic Party about?
So, that's a complicated issue, because you have people who are like, hey, listen, she needs to resign so Governor Newsom can appoint someone there and you can get her seats on her seat on the committees which she's assigned. But it's not a guarantee that Republicans will allow her replacement to be seated. So that there's a bit of a wrinkle there, particularly when we talk about.
Explain that for our listeners who don't understand.
So what happens is most committees in D.C. and the Senate are When it's this split, 51-49 overall, you'll usually have a 15-person committee, and 8 persons would be from the majority party and 7 mm-hmm. persons from the minority party. With Senator Feinstein missing so many votes, it put things at a 7-7 split, so it made things really difficult to move legislation outside of committee. Mm-hmm. And so the thinking for the layperson, right, is that, oh, well, if we can replace her, then that'll give Democrats 8 seats on the committee again. But people have to vote on seating that person, mm-hmm. and so there's no guarantee that replacement would be seated, so you could still be stuck in a 7-7 logjam all the way through next year. Mm-hmm. And let me remind our listeners that even though next year is a presidential year, control of the Senate is at play, and it's a map that favors Republicans. You have states like Montana and West Virginia mm-hmm. that voted for Donald Trump, that are more conservative, that have Democratic leadership. And so, I mean, we're in a sprint for the next 18 months, really, for 2 major chambers, the leadership of the executive branch mm-hmm. and the Senate. Now, Republicans already control the House. It's a very narrow margin. Mm-hmm. And so we could see sort of a, if 2022 continues where Republicans did not get the gains that they wanted, you could end up with a scenario where Democrats have the House and Republicans have the Senate and the White House. So there's a lot at play. But for folks here in Georgia, beyond March 12th and until November of next year, and you don't have a major person running in Georgia, mm-hmm. so you'll have a spring and summer where you don't have to listen to radio ads as much. but they're coming.
But you mentioned it. Listen, West Virginia, Arizona,
yeah.
And those are the current senators, which have had some issues with their
yeah.
their
Kristen Sinema,
which now she's independent. Right. Okay, so those are 2 to watch as well.
Absolutely. You know, and Arizona is one of those interesting states. You know, we used to think about swing states in the country as being Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, and mm-hmm. then, you know, Nevada. Now that's shifted a little bit. Florida is no longer considered a swing state with Ron DeSantis winning by 19 points mm-hmm. last year. North Carolina is not really a swing state. Georgia has been solidified as a swing state. And now you add to it Nevada and Arizona. And so, you know, it was interesting when Sinema, and we talked about this on air last year after the regular election, but before the runoff, when people were saying, oh, the Democrats secured the Senate majority. And we're like, no, they did not.
Yeah.
When you had 2 people in Manchin and Sinema who could easily flip, well, and Sinema did. But as part of that deal, from what I read and heard at the time, was that Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, agreed not to actively run anyone against her. So, and to fund them. So she...
Always willing and dealing.
Don't always willing politics. And dealing. A little bit of amnesty. I mean, I tell you, you know, it's an interesting game.
Let's talk about this GOP convention next week. And we know that Donald Trump's going to attend. Governor Brian Kemp says, nah, y'all don't need to see me. Quote from his folks saying the governor is going to remain focused on making sure we replicate our successes last November and win at the ballot box in 2024 and 2026.
Yeah. So keep in mind, it's not just him, but it's mm-hmm. also the Attorney General who said he's not going to go. And it's also the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who said he's not going to go. But the Lieutenant Governor, who we saw in this last session, tried to govern to the right of mm-hmm. Governor Kemp, is planning on attending. And so to me, that's one of the, there's this interesting divide in the Republican Party right now. The Kemp wing won heavily last year. But then you have this Trump wing, that's Donald Trump, Burt Jones, a handful of senators and representatives, and then, of course, based on the election results from the county parties, that wing of the party mm-hmm. is really dominating the local level. So you have that, but then you have Brian Kemp, who has all the money.
Mm-hmm.
So this is fascinating what's happening right now.
Is it too early to start thinking about for the Democrats here in Georgia 2026?
Absolutely not. The Republicans are thinking about it. Yeah. I mean, again, you know, Burt Jones.
I think Burt Jones is thinking about it.
Yeah, he's floated out there. Chris Carr has pretty much put it out there as well. And we know there'll be a few others. So the Democrats certainly need to be thinking about that. And of course, the first question for Democrats is,
I heard a name. And I don't want to be that person, you know, on the Sunday morning talk shows. Well, I heard. But yeah, I heard a name. There was a former mayor of Atlanta.
I'm assuming you don't mean Kasim. No, I'm joking. So there are a few names. If you're asking me that, I think that Mayor Bottoms, she is keeping her profile very high. I think that she would have the support of the administration, assuming there's still the administration mm-hmm. in 2026. She can raise money like there's nobody's business. And so I think she could be quite formidable. And if Stacey Abrams is off the scene, She definitely can fill that void nationally and in state without the baggage.
Anybody currently in the state legislature?
Yeah. So
that you think?
So I think there are a few names that are of interest to me, right? So I think that, and please don't call, text, whatever. I've not had any conversation. Well, you can call and text and say great show, but I have not had any conversations with anyone about
full this. Disclosure.
Right, full disclosure. But I think that Jason Estevez, the state senator, former APS school board chair.
Yeah, wow.
He's Afro-Latino. He's really established a strong name for himself. A lawyer, Emory, from Columbus, so he's not from Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
He's from South Georgia. And I think he would be very interesting in terms of the state Senate. I think also former state Senate, the person he followed, Jen Jordan, who mm-hmm. ran last year, I think she could be very interesting. I think that also on the Democratic side, I think that you got to look at other people like, I think of someone like Lucy McBath, who's not in the state legislature, but in Congress. And they've been floating her name.
Yeah.
I've heard her name quite a bit lately.
I have heard that. Now, I'm going to throw his name out because I've known him for a long time, and I just like to say his name sometimes so he can send me an email. Michael Thurman?
And, of course, let me just say this. So, and I was getting there because I was saving that one for last. And here's what's interesting, y'all. So Michael Thurman is the sitting CEO of DeKalb County.
Yep.
He's term limited. His term mm-hmm. ends December 31st of 2024.
Mm-hmm.
If I were him, and just full disclosure, he and I have not had a conversation. He has
here
a political consultant, right? He has a person with whom he works, right? I would take a month off, and I would announce in February of 2025, fresh off of that. And the reason why is that DeKalb County, depending on how you cut your data, is either the number one or the number two
mm-hmm.
County in terms of Democratic performance in the entire state. It is more Democratic than Fulton County, and that is 85-86% Democrat. There are no sitting Republican elected officials. And if you can corral 200,000-300,000 votes, which he certainly would, he would mm-hmm. he would dominate DeKalb County with anyone in the race, then he's starting with a huge advantage. So I think CEO Thurman is a really strong name.
And there's something else at play in here, and that is, we're going to have a mayoral race coming up.
Oh, in 2025?
Yeah. In between all of this, you just never know.
Mayor Dickens is going to be reelected. There's not a... Now, I don't think that... I know with the whole Cop City thing happening, or police training facility, I should say, referred to by its formal name, or police and fire training facility, that I know that that's a big... that is a big issue, but... when you look at the city as a whole, I think that this is not indicative of how I feel about it personally. Just looking at it from a numbers perspective, I think that Buckhead is very supportive of it. I think that people in Southwest Atlanta are fairly neutral to slightly supportive. Fairly neutral to supportive. Now, where you get it, the resistance to the training facility is on the east side. Down there by the facility, that's where you have the biggest resistance, and of course in the spillover part of DeKalb County. But a lot of the other parts of the city, it's just not something that's on people's radar in terms of how they vote.
This is something that I'd like to give credit where credit is due, because when you told me this a few years ago, you've always said, Rose, look for billions to be spent, even with the Senate campaign.
Yeah.
And look, we're going to expect to see a lot of money coming into Georgia, a lot of money.
So I'm glad.
And where is it coming from, Fred?
So a couple of things. Number one, people were really disappointed when the Secretary of State announced that the Georgia primary is going to be the Tuesday after Super Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually quite beneficial for all the people who make money off of politics, because the thinking is that given that Donald Trump's trial, he'll go to trial in Georgia somewhere right around that time, March, April.
Possibly.
Yeah. And then he still has he has a lot of legal issues that are all coming will come to head sometime in the spring, it looks like. So there's a very good possibility that you won't have a person who clinches the nomination on Super Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
So Georgia, being the biggest of the four states, is still a big prize. And here's the thing. It's 1 week after Super Tuesday,
yeah.
So people still have to spend all the money in Georgia before that, because they don't know how Super Tuesday is going to work out. So end of February, beginning of March, you're going to get text messages. If you're on the Republican side, Democrats won't have this. But, you'll get text messages, you'll get phone calls, and there'll be a ton of money spent.
Ton of money.
You have to do it.
All right. That's it for this edition of Closer Look. Fred, thank you so much as always. Fred Hicks, Atlanta-based political strategist. We appreciate you.
Thank you. Glad to be back in studio.
All right. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Tiffany Griffith is our supervising producer. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderworth. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.